Okay, everyone. So let us come back to the questions again. And there's a nice bunch of questions here, so we're going to probably take all evening, which is great. So we'll see what happens. All right. So, dear Ajahn, in the sutta today, we spoke of confidence in renunciation and peace. I imagine the Buddha to be was speaking from the refined perspective of renunciation into the jhanas. Can cultivation of confidence in renunciation and peace begin with noticing what burdens and sensory irritations, moments or periods of relative peace are free of? Yes. So, the idea of renouncing or of kind of moving towards peace, it is always about noticing when the mind is peaceful, when the mind is free of things, when the mind feels right. And all of this is part or parcel of this practice. And in fact, this is a very important part of the idea of reflecting on your meditation. Every time you sit down, is to look at the end and to try to understand how the mind actually works. What does it mean to let go? What does it mean to use your perceptions in such a way that they lead to peace? And all of these things are what you actually discover as you investigate at the end of the meditation. This is kind of the purpose of investigating things. Understanding that when certain things fade away, and fading away is a kind of renunciation, because you are giving things up, you're letting things go, then they fade away and eventually they cease. You will notice that it actually gives rise to peace. It gives rise to a kind of a freedom from burdens. And so this is very much a part of this, very much part of the actual meditation practice itself. So it is always a mixture of confidence in the Buddha's teaching and learning and kind of building up that confidence through your own experience and seeing the experience and seeing the experiencing matching with the suttas. The two coming together gives rise to a lot of confidence, I suppose. Good. All right. Go on to the next one. Dear Ajahn, can you explain what placing the mind and keeping it connected means for the jhana, the first absorption? Okay, so this is the translation by Bhantasujato of two terms that you find in the first jhana formula. Vitakka and vichara are the two terms. Sometimes these things are translated as thought and examination, because vitakka in some context it means thinking, and so they bring that idea into the jhana states. But it is not really suitable to translate this in the jhanas. All the words, their meaning come from context. Words don't have fixed meanings irrespective of context. Context is what gives any word its meaning. And the same thing is true for vitakka and vichara. So what we know about these words is that vitakka and vichara, they cease, they come to an end in the second jhana. So what we know is that the first jhana is the most refined possible aspect of vitakka and vichara. And so when you try to reflect on what is the most refined aspect of thinking, of using the mind, then essentially it comes down to this idea of the movement of the mind, very simple movement of the mind. And the way this is explained in the commentaries, in particular, is the idea of the kind of the mind moving on to the object, and then sort of holding on a little bit to the object. And the moving towards the object is what he here calls placing the mind. You're kind of placing the mind onto the object. And then it holds on for a while, and then it recedes. And there's like this kind of a wave or pulsing effect in the first jhana. The moving, the receding, the moving on, the receding, the moving on, and this kind of rhythm, in a sense. That's what the first jhana, the experience of these states, are like. So this is why he translates in this way, because he's getting away from using misleading words like thinking and examination, because actually that's not at all what is going on. And it leads to all kinds of misunderstandings, and it leads to many people in the world thinking that jhanas are really easy, because thinking is really easy, so if you can think, then you can be in jhana. That's kind of the idea. And it's kind of crazy when you think about it, because of course thinking is a very core state of mind, and the jhanas are incredibly elevated states of mind. These do not really belong together, and you get problems. And if you misinterpret the jhanas, then you misinterpret the idea of samadhi, you misinterpret nibbana, you misinterpret the whole path, and there's no way you're going to be able to reach the elevated states of this path when you get these kind of misinterpretations. So that is what that is about, roughly. And if you want to study more about the words vitakka and vichara and how they're used in the jhana, you can look in the Visuddhimagga. The Visuddhimagga is where these things are explained in detail. You don't really find a detailed explanation in the suttas. You have to kind of infer what it means from context. Dear Ajahn, can you please talk about how to become a deeply moral person and to develop Hiriyotapa? Thank you. How to become a deeply moral person. All right. Deeply moral basically means that the morality goes to the very core of your being. Yeah, in a sense that you always want to do the right thing. Your mind inclines towards doing the right thing. You want to speak with kind words at all times. You don't really, it happens automatically. It kind of just happens because deep inside you know that this is the only way to live and the only way that makes any sense from the idea of the Buddhist path. And the way to do that is to understand the significance and the importance of morality. It is really part of the brainwashing of listening to the word of the Buddha. And the more you understand the importance of this, how this is actually what brings you forward on the path. This is what makes meditation possible. This is what brings rise to the joy and the happiness and ultimately finding the very meaning of life itself. This is what makes it possible. It's kind of extraordinary. The more you read the suttas and you start to see the way the sila is always at the foundation of everything, always the root cause of the entire practice, after a while it becomes clear that this is what it is about. And if the meditation isn't working, it means the sila and the depth of morality hasn't really gone far enough yet. You need to take it further. So you need to kind of change. You start to understand every time you do something which isn't quite right, every time you have a bad thought, every time you say something which isn't quite right, you're letting yourself down. You're blocking access to these beautiful things. And it becomes like a matter of life and death almost. I have to get this right. It is so important. And when you start to understand how important it is, what it does, these things then get kind of imprinted in your mindfulness. Your mindfulness always goes back to these things because it is so important. It's like your sense of, it's like being alive. You want to be alive. If someone threatens your life, you don't need to kind of think twice about whether they are, whether you want to escape from that or not. The instinct to live is very, very powerful in human beings. You don't need to think about whether you want to live or not. It kind of happens automatically. If someone wants to do something bad towards you, you kind of recoil from that and you get away and you know how to protect yourself. But in many ways, sila, morality, is more important than whether you live or not. This is more important than being alive. Why? Well, because this is actually what determines your long-term future. Whether you die or not doesn't really determine your long-term future. You get reborn, you carry on somewhere. But morality is actually what matters for whether in the long run you are going to be happy and successful in your spiritual practice and whether you're going to find true meaning in life. This is what really matters. So kind of brainwash yourself again and again to understand the importance of this. Don't allow yourself to let yourself down by doing the wrong thing, thinking in the wrong way. This is really, the entire spiritual path depends on this. And from that morality, the idea of meditation practice, it's an automatic process. You see this again and again in the suttas, the idea that there's no need to do any, to have any will or to apply yourself. It happens automatically. And this is why what we're trying to do in meditation is just to sit back and allow the process to happen. Just resting, just enjoying what sitting here, not really trying anything, not focusing on the breath, not doing anything, just allowing things to unfold. Because if the sila, the morality, is established properly, then it will unfold in the right way. So this is how you become a deeply moral person. Brainwash yourself again and again and again. Understand how important it is. So it's lodged in your mind as a force, something you always can come back to, something you never can really forget. This is the most important thing in your life. Everything else is secondary. Then you're on the right track. And to develop hiryotapa, well, that's the same kind of thing. Hiryotapa is a sense of a fear of the consequences, a shame and fear of the consequences. So you are afraid, you know the consequences of doing the wrong thing are really bad. You have this opportunity to live the spiritual life. You don't know how long it's going to last. You don't know whether what's going to happen in your next life. Now is the opportunity. If you don't take it now, you have no idea what's going to happen. It's urgent. This is kind of the idea here. All right. What is the difference between karma and merit? How do you silence the inner chatter voice? It doesn't stop during meditation, analyzing and commenting on everything. Thank you. So I think you're probably in good company. There's probably quite a few people analyze a little bit too much. They try to analyze the difference between karma and merit, for example. That's one of the analyses. So what is the difference? And the difference is that karma is the general law of how intention conditions how you feel. Feelings are conditioned by karma. So if you, there's two kinds of karma, either your karma is good or it's bad, and that depends on your intentions. So if you have good intentions, you make good karma. If you have bad intentions, you're making bad karma. And if you make bad karma, you will feel bad about yourself. You make good karma, you feel good about yourself. So there's a link between how you feel about yourself or how you experience life in general, the feelings you have and the intentions you have. Intentions and feelings, that's kind of the link of karma. Merit is just a particular kind of karma. So when you're making merit, you're making good karma. That's really what it means. And there's different ways of making merit, punya. There is the kind of merit of generosity, and there's a merit of meditation. And so these are some of the bhavana, punya, and the, what's it called? So these are kind of the basic idea. Merit is always about positive karma. And karma can be positive or negative, depending on your state of mind. How do you silence the inner chatter and the voice? It doesn't stop. So what you have to do is to, notice why it is you have the inner chatter and voice. And what you will notice that there are usually some very obvious reasons for that. One of the reasons is because you are interested in those things. What is your inner chatter about? And sometimes it is about crazy things, and you wonder, why am I thinking about that? And sometimes it's because the mind just wants to chatter about anything rather than being silent. This is one of the problems. And why does the mind want to chatter rather than be silent? Because it doesn't really enjoy the silence. You haven't really found that joy in it yet. And so one of the answers to overcome the chatter is always to enjoy the meditation. If you don't enjoy the meditation, if you find that you are forcing yourself to sit here and you don't really enjoy it, please don't do that. Get up, do something else. It's better to meditate only half an hour every day rather than forcing yourself to sit for however long it might be. Enjoying it is more important than anything else. So just make sure you enjoy what you're doing here. Otherwise, this is exactly the outcome. Either the mind will go asleep, or it will chatter, or will do all kinds of things because there's no happiness in what you're doing. So enjoy it. Relax. You are here to rest. You're on a holiday. This is the best kind of holiday you can have. Meditation retreat at Jhana Grove. This is number one holiday in the world. And most people don't even get that. And they are because they haven't got a clue what's going on. And then the greatest holiday of all is when the meditation really starts to bite. And you get into a deep state of meditation, and you're just blissing out and enjoying yourself. The mind gets regenerated. You get energy coming back into the mind. This is a real holiday in the world, when really you get energy back. Most people, they go on a holiday and they come back and they're more exhausted when they left because of all the business and all the activities they do on holiday. But here, if you get the meditation right, you feel really regenerated. This is the real holiday. This is where you kind of take a break from all those things that deplete your energy, the thinking, the doing, all of these kind of things. One of the things I recommend you to notice in your meditation is when the doing stops, when the mind starts to become peaceful, how delightful that is when the mind becomes peaceful. And you start to understand the torture of craving, the torture of doing, the torture of always controlling, the torture of being attached to things and having to do things. When the mind is peaceful, that is when the mind feels kind of liberated from something. It's the liberation of the torture inside. So enjoy what you're doing. Try to understand how fortunate you are to be here. Have a sense of gratitude for what is here. Even gratitude to yourself for bringing yourself here. Gratitude for the company, the people around you. Gratitude to the Buddha, to the teachings, to all of these wonderful things coming together. There's a lot to be grateful for if you are here. You are on the path to something beautiful and wonderful. What an amazing thing that is. So find that positive feelings inside. And as you do that, this whole thing starts to come together. So we have the inner chatter because we think it is interesting. The world is interesting. We think that we're going to resolve. Sometimes it's about resolving things, about solving problems in our mind, thinking about the future, what we're going to do. But that doesn't solve anything. Why? Because even if you find a solution, there's another problem waiting behind to be solved. And we've been doing this already for lifetimes and lifetimes. And the reason you're still here is because you've been doing this for lifetimes before. It never got you anywhere except for being stuck in samsara. So now is the time to stop. This is not how you build the future. You build the future by being quiet and silent and enjoying what is going on here now. And once you get that, that is how you build the future, then the whole idea of chatting about it, thinking about it, becomes nonsensical and is far easier to let go. At other times, the mind chatters because it is bored, nothing else to do, bored, chatting away, thinking about all kind of crazy things. And again, you have to find that lack of boredom in enjoying your meditation is really the path forward. So it takes time. Remember that the mind is conditioned, it is full of habits, and to enable this to happen is going to take time. You have to recondition yourself slowly, slowly, slowly. It is not easy. These things are gradual things. It's not something you can do on the spot, but you may find that during this retreat there will be times when suddenly you feel peaceful and suddenly you understand what is going on. But then you keep on practicing, and next time you come back to Jhana Grove, whenever that is, you find that actually things have changed. Why? Because you've been living well on the outside. You're prepared. You have more right view, and you're prepared for the meditation as a consequence. Right view and sila, these are the two things that make meditation possible. All right. Dear Ajahn Brahmali, a big show of appreciation and gratitude to Christina and Norlia, working tirelessly in the kitchen to keep us happy and warm. They never seem to stop moving from the wee hours of the morning and onwards. Thanks to Ajahn for your super-duper teaching, as always. This morning, you said our thoughts arise out of desire and wanting, that there's intention in our thoughts. I found this troubling. Indeed, sometimes that can be really troubling. Used to think they were just human defilements which I had to uproot, but now they are expressions of my intentions I'm sometimes unaware of. What does it mean for my practice? So what it means is it shows the importance of purifying our intentions, right? Your intentions are purified through the practice of sila and through learning to rethink of the world in a new way. And by learning to think about everything in a new way, your intentions automatically change. Your whole thinking pattern starts to change. So you don't have to watch it in each individual intention, but by globally looking at the world and looking at people in a new way, all of these small intentions will just change accordingly, and they will fall in line with a larger picture of things. So you start to look at people in a new way. One of the most important things, which I haven't really talked about much on this retreat, it's not really part of the suttas, is how we think about people in the world. This matters so enormously, because the people are the most... People are this weird thing. On the one hand, they are the things that are most dear to us in the world. On the other hand, they are the things that are most difficult in the world. It's like this kind of two-sided thing, And people are the things that we get most upset with. They are the things that really cause us, who we get angry with the most are people. And so understanding people is such a fundamental thing on the Buddhist path. And the way to understand people is to understand that they are conditioned. They are trapped in the way they are. They don't have much choice but to behave the way they do, because the past is holding them through their habits and whatever it might be. And once you understand that people are victims of their conditioning, victims of their past, victims of their personality, once you understand this, then you can have compassion for them, because victims are always worthy of compassion. And each one of us here, everyone in the whole world, is a victim of their past conditioning. You cannot change that conditioning. You come into this life with a certain amount of conditioning, and then you build up that conditioning even more. And you are a function of that. You may think that you have freedom of choice, that you can decide what to do, because that's what it feels like. It feels like right now I am, doing whatever. I'm choosing to have a sip of water. But how free is that choice? Even though it feels free, how free is it? And the more you start to understand your mind, the more you start to understand that actually there is very little freedom there. There's all the conditions from the past and the present coming together, and that makes you choose in a certain way. This is how choice happens. It happens through conditioning. Very often when you look back on your life, if I look back 30 years ago, who I was or whatever it is, and I look back and at that time it seemed like I was making choices. But when I look back, it sort of looks more and more as if I was trapped at that particular time. It almost seems like things were happening according to a certain system, and I didn't really have much choice at all. So in the present, it can feel as if we're making choices. But in retrospect, looking back, actually it looks more like we are just kind of railroaded down a certain track, which is our conditioning. So investigate that. And as you see that, you start to have more compassion, not just for others, but for yourself as well, because you are also part of this conditioning. You don't buy into this feeling that you are autonomous. It feels like we're autonomous, but that feeling itself is suspect. This is why the teachings of anatta, of non-self, is so important in Buddhism, because it allows us to take a new view of these things. We are far less autonomous than we think. And this is kind of the problem. The feeling inside of autonomy is a false feeling, according to the Buddha. Our choices are not really ours. Our choices are conditioned. And this is how you start to have compassion for everyone in the world. Not only do you have compassion for everyone because you understand that we're all trapped, and then you rejoice in the goodness when you see goodness in the world. Like people coming together, practicing meditation together, trying to live in a good way. What a wonderful thing it is. Everyone who is here on this retreat is worthy of respect. And the reason why you're worthy of respect, because you're trying. You want to do the right thing. And you may not be perfect, but so what? At least you want to do the right thing. And what a wonderful thing that is. And remember that you're worthy of respect. Because the moment you feel that sense of self-worth and self-value, it enables also the meditation to work because of that. So this is how you gradually overcome these things. Please make sure that the main thing to deal with, I've been talking a lot about sensual pleasures and the five senses on this retreat, but even more fundamental is the overcoming of ill will and negativity towards others. That is really the most important thing of all. So make sure that if there are people in the world that you are having trouble with, make sure that you try to use this kind of perceptions to overcome that trouble. Have compassion for them. Even the bad people in the world, they too are trapped. They too are victims from a higher kind of viewpoint. And then there's no one in the world you really need to be angry with. So something like that, yeah? And then gradually, as you change your view and you build up this idea that Buddha calls right view, samaditti, at the foundation of the path, all your intentions, everything else, that all falls into place according to that broader idea of right view. All right. Okay. Dear Ajahn, I understand that monastics eat at or after dawn. Do you keep track to the dawn time? Do you keep track to the dawn time specifically? We don't eat at dawn, we always eat after dawn. Yeah, we don't kind of keep now is dawn, quickly eat now because now is dawn. No, it doesn't work like that. You wait till dawn has passed and then you eat. Yeah, because at dawn is only one moment long, it's a very short time to eat. Yeah, so you better eat afterwards. From dawn until the sun gets into the zenith position, the highest point in the sky, that is the time that we eat. Usually it's taken to be 12 o'clock, but 12 o'clock is not really quite right. Actually, it's the zenith position, which is the right time to eat. So that is when monastics eat, and that is when lay people eat, when they are on the eight precepts as well. Yeah, so you're all kind of part of that as you are here. All right. Dear Ajahn, the Buddha speaks of having superhuman clairvoyance. Can you explain how I can learn to develop this? Are you able to run a workshop aimed at developing clairvoyance? If not, can you please point me in the direction of someone who can? Thank you so much. I can tell you how to do this quite easily. It's actually very easy to become clairvoyant. Yeah, super easy. It's not very hard at all. So all you have to do is you have to sit down, come in here, meditate, go into the fourth jhana, and coming out of the fourth jhana, you guide your mind towards clairvoyance, and bang, you are clairvoyant. So that's all you have to do. basically, you have to almost like these are very profound things. And unless your power of samadhi is incredibly powerful, you won't be able to do these kind of things. It takes very, very powerful samadhi. It's very rare for people to get into these very profound jhana states. Occasionally you have people who kind of get into a jhana maybe here and there. And there are some monks who get into, and nuns also I would think, who get into these states. But it's not very common. It actually takes a lot of commitment and perseverance on the path to get there. It's much more difficult for a layperson than for a monastic, because this is kind of what monasticism is kind of supporting you to achieve these sort of things. So first of all, just sit down, get into the first jhana, and once you get into the first jhana, come back to me and we'll take it from there. Okay, dear Ajahn, what I heard, Ajahn, Buddha's last words were, this is what I heard, Ajahn, Buddha's last words were, all conditioned things are of a nature to decay, strive on untiringly. Yes, something like that. Vaya Dhamma Sankara Appamadena Sampadeta is the Pali here. Questions. One, when did he say it? Whom did the Buddha talk these words? What did the Buddha actually mean? How do I relate those words to my daily life? Many thanks. Okay, so these are very, very good questions, actually, and very important questions. So thank you for bringing this out. These are indeed the last words of the Buddha, Vaya Dhamma Sankhara. So sankharas are basically all phenomena, all things are, this is what is meant by sankhara in this context. And vaya dhamma means having an age not just to decay, but to end, yeah, to disappear completely. Yeah? So all things have the nature to end, is a more, probably more accurate translation. Yeah? And apamadena sampadeta means strive on with apamada, with heedfulness, with carefulness, yeah, not just untiringly, but wisely. That is the point of apamadena sampadeta, yeah, with wisdom, with heedfulness, with circumspection. This is kind of the very important point. It's not just striving blindly, but being wise about how you're striving. So you can see here how translation is quite difficult, and it's difficult to get the meaning really right, and get the meaning slightly different, and suddenly it means something, and you start doing the wrong thing as a consequence. So when did the Buddha say this? Well, as you say, it was the last words. So the Buddha was on his deathbed. He was just lying, lying and ready, waiting to die, basically. And he was kind of giving the last teachings to his monks. And all the monks were there around at that time. And then the Buddha says these things. He finishes all the things that he has to say. He asks the monastics, do you have any more questions? Yeah, this is your last opportunity. Please take it. There are no questions. And then he says this. Yeah, Vaya Dhamma Sankhara Apamadena Sampadeta. So this is the time, yeah, just before he's about to die. Yeah? And these were the monastic disciples that he said this to as he was at this last point. What did he actually mean? So what he means, you can take it that these words, being the last words of the Buddha, are a summary of his entire teachings. Yeah? This is really what it is. It's a summary of all the teaching that he has done over 45 years. That summary then means, first of all, that all phenomena have the nature to end. This is the idea of impermanence, the idea of uncertainty. And the idea of impermanence is the underlying idea that leads to all the other things in Buddhism. That leads to the idea of suffering, leads to the idea of non-self. It leads to the idea that there's nothing to hold on to in the world. Nothing is reliable. The whole spiritual path emerges out of this idea of impermanence, of unreliability, of uncertainty of all the phenomena in the world. So impermanence is a very important thing to contemplate, because it kind of drives home the point, the importance of the spiritual practice, because the world is so utterly unreliable. So this is what he means. And so once you have that right view, that everything is impermanent, you can call this right view, then from that comes the idea, I better do something about it. Yeah, it is unacceptable that everything is kind of impermanent. It means that I'm going to suffer endlessly down the path. Okay, I've got to practice the spiritual path. And the spiritual path is then summarized as apamadena sampadeta. Yeah, strive on, or carry on maybe, carry on with heedfulness. Yeah, be wise, be careful, be circumspect. Carry on, don't stop. Don't stop in the stream, nor strive, but find that middle way where you use wisdom to kind of move forward in your practice. So right view, and then the path of practice emerging from that right view. This is what we're seeing in the last words of the Buddha. So how do I relate those words to my daily life? And this is how you relate it. Yeah, you remember that everything in the life is uncertain. Remember that everything you try to hold on to in life, what are the things that we hold on to? Well, relationships, people, maybe some of our possessions like our house maybe, ideas about the world, yeah, about the world being stable and kind of whatever. All of these things that whenever you find yourself thinking, oh no, yeah, this is bad, you're getting sick, or there's a war in the world. If you don't like what is happening, you know you have an attachment, you know there's a problem there. You're not ready, you haven't really accepted the impermanence there. So whenever you are shocked or dismayed or you feel suffering because of a development in the world, that is where you have a problem. You're holding on to something. And you can see this in your daily life. You haven't really grasped the idea of impermanence fully yet. And then you understand the importance of the spiritual path. Okay. Dear Ajahn, what are some skillful things one can do when meditation or even formal practice in general from time to time starts feeling unpleasant to the point of the mind rebels against them? Thank you for bringing the suttas to life. So this is the problem. Sometimes the meditation becomes unpleasant, and it becomes unpleasant when you are focusing too hard on the breath, and you are too close to the breath. You're losing that space between you and the breath. The mindfulness is not strong enough anymore, and you kind of lose yourself, and there's too much willpower. And it's a very common problem. And then the meditation itself becomes unpleasant. So if the meditation starts to become unpleasant, try a little bit to overcome it. Go back to square one. Let completely go of the breath utterly. Don't have anything to do with the breath anymore. Lie down or change. That might be a good point to change your posture. So you have like a bit of a break in between. And then you can try to carry on. But if it keeps on being unpleasant, don't stay with that lack of pleasure for too long. Because if you do, you're going to get really fed up with meditation. It's going to feel terrible. So do something else. Go for a walk, whatever it is that you want to do. But don't keep on meditating if it gets very unpleasant. So it is just a sign that there's too much willpower used. That's when the meditation becomes unpleasant. You need to let go more. You need to just be with rather than controlling. And this is the thing here. Sometimes once you get into that mindset, it can be very hard to let go. So sometimes it's better just to do something else and then try a different thing. Sometimes you may want to lie down a little bit. One of the nice things about lying down is that lying down reminds you of sleep. So when you are going to sleep, kind of the thing is to let go because you want to fall asleep. So it kind of tends to lean the mind in the right direction, towards letting go. So if you wish, try to lie down a little bit. That's perfectly okay. You can even do that in this room. I don't know, maybe somewhere towards the back or something. Not sure, whatever it is kind of convenient. And then see what happens. Sometimes we need to try different things and experiment a bit and see what happens. Okay. Ajahn, how can I eat less sweets at lunch? Thank you. Why do you want to eat less sweets? This is the first question you should ask. Why? Well, maybe it's okay to eat those sweets. You have 9 days here, and I say, don't worry too much about those sweets. That's not a big deal. Probably the reason you want to eat sweets is because there's not that many sensual pleasures here, so you kind of take the opportunity to indulge in sensual pleasures at the mealtime. That's probably the reason. So again, the answer to this usually is that you have to enjoy the spiritual path. That is always the answer. If you enjoy the spiritual path more, you get some happiness in your meditation, then the sensual pleasures are going to be less important to you, and then you eat less sweets. But if you force yourself to eat less sweets, then chances are your meditation might get even worse. Because you're forcing your mind not to have any happiness, and then you get really grumpy, and you get really bad mood, and you meditate, and you fume comes out of your ears. And then next day you eat even more sweets, to compensate for all that kind of ill will. You're going to go like this. Don't try too hard to do anything like that. Just kind of stay with it. Don't be upset with yourself for eating too many sweets. Being upset with yourself is usually utterly counterproductive. Just watch yourself and see what happens. And sometimes when you watch yourself, the solution just arises out of nowhere. Suddenly you know what you're doing, and then you stop eating sweets as a consequence. All right. Dear Ajahn, why is it that we forget our past lives? Wouldn't it be easier to remember the mistakes, bad karma, so we don't repeat them? Yes, it would be easier. I think that's probably true. But that's kind of, just because it would be easier doesn't mean that you're going to remember it, right? That's kind of the that's the thing here. So, yes, it would be helpful. I think that if we remembered our past life in general, it would be a great spur to practice, actually, because you start to understand the problems with the past lives. So why do we forget our past lives? Probably because we have to go through the whole process of being reborn. And being reborn is not necessarily a very nice process. Yeah, your consciousness gets established in a tiny little fetus somewhere, and then you have to kind of go through that whole process of kind of growing up or whatever. No wonder you forget things, yeah, when you kind of, when these sort of, probably quite traumatic to go through that whole process. And that is probably why you remember your past life. But if you get reborn as a deva, as a god, yeah, as kind of a higher kind of being, then they will often remember their past lives. Yeah, so they often would remember, oh yeah, I was kind of, before these are my friends down there, yeah, on the human realm, and you remember your past friends, and you kind of have a memory, because you don't go through that kind of difficult process of being reborn that you do if you are a human or you're an animal or whatever. So devas have a tendency to remember their past lives more. So that is... perhaps the reason, I'm just speculating, it doesn't say anywhere in the suttas, I'm just kind of guessing what might be the cause there. Okay, so next one. Dear Ajahn, thank you for your very inspiring teachings. Most of the senior monks teach us to stay in the present moment, but why some people try to see their past lives through meditation? What do they gain if they saw them as dirty animals like pigs in the past lives? They will be feeling miserable, so isn't it better not to know about the past lives? Of course, if they see them as devas, they will be happy. Thanks with metta. Yes, it is good to stay in the present moment, but again, you have to be careful with these things, because that can become another straitjacket. Must be in the present, and then you use all your willpower to stay in the present, and actually becomes unpleasant, and the whole thing kind of falls apart again. So stay in the present, but make it happen naturally. Put in the causes and conditions that make the mind want to be in the present. When the mind wants to be in the present, then it is easy. The Ajahn Brahm has this nice catchphrase, make the present moment the pleasant moment. That's easy to remember. Make the present moment the pleasant moment. And because when the present moment is pleasant, you want to be in the present. Makes sense, right? This is one of the reasons why the sila is so important, because it actually allows you to enjoy the present. When you enjoy the present, it is easy to stay in the present. So again, it's about not using willpower, but allowing the path to mature in the right way. And then these things happen as a consequence. If you deliberately want to remember your past lives, it's a very good idea. And if you do remember your past life as a dirty pig, as you say here, then probably that's a really good idea. It may not be fun, it may be painful, it may be miserable, but that's kind of the point. The point is to see reality, right? If you think you were a pig in the past life, I don't know if that's what you think, maybe you have a feeling that that may have been the case. Seeing it is very, very powerful. It is very kind of strong, because what you see is that you see something that you start to understand, this whole cycle of existence, going up, going down, going sideways, never really learning from your experience, because you forget about them from one life to the next one. I think there is a reason why in the biography of the Buddha remembers his past life before his awakening. And the reason is because when you remember your past life, lives, it is a way of understanding suffering. And there's many ways of approaching the idea of suffering, but one of the most important ways is to remember your past lives. You get this bird's eye view, you see this, I was going to say horror show, but... There's some truth to that, right? It's, you see this thing kind of stretching back, potentially without beginning in the past. And you start to understand that there's a big, big problem here. So remembering past life actually is very powerful for understanding dukkha, understanding suffering, understanding the problem that we have in this world. That is the reason why we do that. All right. Okay, have any lay people ever become enlightened? Have any lay people ever become enlightened? The answer to that question is yes. That's the short answer. The way that this happens is that once, if you do become enlightened as a lay person, you give up the lay people identity straight away. You no longer identify as a lay person at that point because you have given up all the things that lay people normally hold on to, like having a house or having a family, and all of that becomes meaningless to you. You don't really have a house anymore. All of that is given up mentally. So in a sense, you become a monastic at the moment that you become enlightened. And you probably will hurry up to the monastery and say, please, I want to become a nun or a monk now because I happen to be enlightened. And if you say to the monastics that you happen to be enlightened, we will say, sure, okay, let's check this out. Yeah, we're not going to kind of get you an easy... There's many, many people who come to the monastery and say they're enlightened. So far, what I've seen, 0% of those people who say that are actually enlightened. Yeah, it is overestimation or misunderstanding and all of these kind of things. But it is possible in theory. And then you become a monastic straight away because you're an arahant. But remember, there's 4 stages of enlightenment. So there is starting off with stream entry, once returning, non-returning, and arahant. And the earlier stages, it's fully possible to be as a layperson. But arahant, really, at that point, that's when you make the change from being a layperson to being a monastic. So it is possible. Is it advisable? What is the best way to become enlightened? Is that to be a layperson or a monastic? Well, if you're ready to become a monastic, that's the best way, because that's why the Buddha laid down the whole idea of monasticism. Otherwise, it doesn't make any sense. Yeah, if it's better to be a layperson, then it's kind of silly to even have a monastic order, if you like. Yeah. All right. Dear Venerable Ajahn Ramali, okay. In the Q&A last night, you did not choose to answer if someone in family life would become a stream enterer. My impression was you may not think this is possible for lay people these days. I think it wasn't on purpose, it was just, I forgot about it probably, that's probably why I didn't answer that. It is possible, The suttas have many examples of lay people experiencing stream entry and higher, or perhaps your response was to encourage focus on the path now. I see the merit in this, and I also think hearing stories about what is possible with the path in the lay life is very inspiring. It is possible to become a stream enterer in lay life, absolutely. There's kind of nothing, there's no real barriers to it, or no absolute barriers. It is useful to kind of use that for inspiration and all of these kind of things. I agree. And the stories are certainly quite abundant, as you say, in the suttas. But I think the best thing to do, whether you are a monastic or a lay person, is to kind of put this aside, this whole idea of becoming a stream mentor and all of these kind of things, because it is a kind of spiritual materialism. It's very easy that these things become blockages on the path rather than inspirations. If you use it for inspiration, great. Please continue doing so. And that is the right way. But if it becomes something that you are desperately trying to achieve, then it can very easily become a blockage. So focus on the causes. Focus on what works. Focus on kindness, compassion, understanding, generosity, wisdom, all of these things. And as you focus on those, then the path will unfold. And if you are ready, then stream entry may even happen. I do know some lay people who are very, very inspiring, and I would not be surprised if some of these people that I know might well be stream entries. It's very hard to really say, but there are some people who do kind of inspire that kind of confidence. It is very rare, and these people that I know, they lead very special kind of lives, lives that are really quite unique. They live almost like monastics. Maybe sometimes more monastic than monastics. So it can be done, but it is actually, it is, so forget, basically allow it to inspire you and then just come back to the causes, and I think then you are on the right track. So good, thank you for that. Dear Ajahn, so much joy came up when I imagined waiting for the Buddha to come on arms round. How wonderful that is. And that's very, very nice of you to say that, because, great. Just imagine for the Buddha to walk down the road. I also remembered hearing Longpo Ganha speaking about the Buddha. He said the Buddha was very simple. He just had some cloth to cover the body, no shoes. His face was full of metta and karuna. He is the most sacrificing person, just sharing here. Excellent. This is really, this is wonderful. And this is kind of the idea of Buddha Nusati, the recollection of the Buddha. You can do this in many different ways. And this idea of the Buddha, this extraordinary person, this extraordinary teacher, who developed himself to the highest kind of possibility. There's someone who has lost the sense of personality, lost the sense of identity, and just become beautiful qualities. The Buddha is really just a bundle of beautiful qualities. That is what a Buddha is. That is, of course, that is an extraordinarily inspiring and wonderful thing in the world. So, good. I'm very glad to hear that. That's excellent. Dear Ajahn, during the guided meditation you mentioned we should watch our mind like a passenger on the train. Can you please explain further how to get involved, how not to get involved in the thoughts? So the idea is to not be involved, right? So when you are on the train, either you are the driver of the train or you are the passenger. So you are not the driver in the simile, you are the passenger. And when you are the passenger, you don't decide where the train goes. You don't go up to the driver and tell the driver, go faster, go slower. I don't know if you do that, but hopefully you don't do that. You become very unpopular very quickly if you do that. You get chucked out of the train if you kind of try to tell the driver what to do. So your job is just to sit in your seat and to watch the scenery. Yeah, you don't know where the train is going to go. You don't know whether it's going to go through some kind of terrible places or beautiful places or whatever. But whatever happens, you have no choice but to stay with what happens. So you sit in your passenger seat and you just watch the landscape on the outside without having any say. And this is a beautiful simile for meditation because it means that you are not in charge. You just have to accept whatever is going on. And you stay with whatever is going on. You watch whatever is going on without involvement. And when we are not involved, the thoughts tend to die down. Because, as I mentioned before, the thoughts are driven by intention. They are driven by our will. So by removing the will and by just enjoying what is going on, actually you are already on the fast track for the thoughts to actually come to an end. Because you're no longer driving them. You're no longer encouraging them. And so the mind tends to calm down as a consequence. This is the idea here. It doesn't always work because sometimes the momentum of thinking and momentum of attending is so strong. But this is kind of the idea behind this. So you are just aware. And then on top of that awareness, you need to enjoy what you're doing. And when you enjoy what you're doing and you are passive, those two things coming together are very powerful. Passive enjoyment. This is what this is about. Okay, I'm going to just finish off. I might go a little bit faster just to finish off these last questions. So let's see what we've got here. Bhante, thank you. Can you talk a bit more about the anusaya kilesas and the sankharas as kamma resultants? I listened carefully to your answer, but missed bits. Okay, so anusaya kilesas, anusayas are the underlying tendencies. So these are the, even though you may not have any kilesa in your mind, you may not have any desires right now, you may not have any ill will, the tendency is still there, present. You will have ill will in the future. And that is because the underlying tendency has not been removed. So the anusaya is the tendency for these things to happen. They can be temporarily moved, but not uprooted completely. So this is the anusaya, underlying tendency. Kilesa is the actual appearance of these defilements in the mind. And the sankharas is usually the will, the action. Sankhara is defined as chetana, intention. But as you say, sankharas can also mean the resultant sankharas, the kamma, if you like, the resultant kamma. And in that case, it just sankharas are just another way of talking about experience, right? Sabbe sankhara dukkha, all phenomena are suffering. In that case, everything, all our experiences are suffering from that kind of point of view. Sabbe sankhara anicca, all sankharas are impermanent. It refers to all conditioned phenomena being impermanent. And because everything is conditioned, it means all phenomena are impermanent. That is sankhara. Sankhara has this twofold meaning. This is kind of confusing. On the one hand, it is what creates the world, it creates life, creates everything. That is the kamma we are making, the chetana. And then you have the resultant of that is the creation of things. And that thing which is created, which is like new life or whatever, that is also called sankhara. All right, so... next one. Dear Ajahn Brahmali, you mentioned this morning to develop right view outside meditation, but within meditation to use right view to lead the meditation to peace. Can you please elaborate? Thank you. Okay, so within meditation, the way to use right view is to just remind yourself of what is important in life. To remind yourself that there is nothing really interesting to think about in the sensory realm. There is no future in that sensory realm. The future is on the spiritual path. And why think about the non-future? Why think about things that are not really interesting? Yeah, this is kind of the point here. The sensory realm is just more of the same. More problems, more going around and around. It's not really interesting. So you realize, actually, why do I think about this? And then you let go of the thinking. So this is one way of using right view inside of meditation. In daily life, the way to use right view is, simple things like what I was talking about before, how to overcome ill will towards other people, to remember that other people are victims of their conditioning, this sort of thing. This is using right view in daily life to overcome the problems and defilements of the mind. Another way of using right view is to remind yourself of impermanence, that things are always changing. So you don't hold on so much, maybe. You're not so concerned about the world going this way or that way. Another way is to remember that the most important thing in life is your spiritual life. And what happens in your daily life is not that important. And so when you lose your job, of course, if you are really dependent on your job for your income, then it's going to be very tricky to lose your job. But if you kind of can get by without that job, you can kind of shrug your shoulders and say, okay, lost my job, okay, no big deal. The spiritual path is what really matters anyway. I can continue the spiritual path without my job, so it's all right. You don't take the sensory world so seriously anymore, and you are moving on to the spiritual practice instead. These are some simple ways of using right view in daily life, remembering the Dhamma in ordinary life. It is just a little bit over time. I just got a few more questions left, and I'm going to just finish it off. So, dear Ajahn, how does the Dalai Lama fit into this? Right, so this is some kind of koan or something, I think. Yeah, this is some. How does the Dalai Lama? But I think the. I think one of the things that I always found about the Dalai Lama, I don't really know that much about him. I think I read one book a long time ago about his teachings, and his teachings are pretty, pretty not bad. Yeah, they're very close to the Theravadan teachings, I would say. He teaches mindfulness of breathing, he teaches metta and compassion and these kind of things, and it's not that different. He doesn't really teach very fancy things. And sometimes when he's asked about these very fancy teachings that you can find in Vajrayana and Mahayana, very often he dismisses it and says, actually, no one is really ready for those teachings anyway. And so he basically, I think the Dalai Lama is pretty, he's pretty good. Yeah. Yes, I've heard that he did some weird things recently, and he was kind of criticized for that, and I think probably for good reasons. But then again, everyone makes mistakes in life. Yeah, so we don't maybe shouldn't take it too seriously. It doesn't annul all the good things that he has done. These days, I get the feeling that if someone makes one mistake, it kind of annuls all the good things that they have done. That's kind of a crazy way of looking at other people. Everyone makes mistakes. We need to have a bit more understanding for each other sometimes, I think. Yeah. Because otherwise we're asking for the impossible. No one is going to be that perfect. We are not going to be that perfect. So how can we expect that of others? So my general impression of the Dharma is actually pretty good. Apart from some of the weird stuff that he has done. Dear Ajahn, is this earth the only place to achieve Nibbana? If so, why? For those in the Deva realm, don't they have the wisdom to achieve Nibbana? Wouldn't they remember some of the words of the Buddha so they can skip the earth? Nibbana can be achieved in different places, in the heavenly realms, in the earthly realms. Yeah, there are examples of that happening, of the devas actually becoming stream mentors, etc. So sometimes people say, oh, I want to be reborn as a human so I can continue practicing. But actually, it is not clear that you can't do that also in the deva loka. So I would say, just go with your karma. Don't try to control things. Usually when you try to control things, you mess it up, and then you get reborn in really the wrong place. Yeah, and that's kind of really a bad idea. So basically, just enjoy. Don't worry too much about what happens next. Just live to the best of your ability, and then your karma will look after you. Last question for tonight. Ajahn, what are the wholesome cravings? Thank you. The wholesome cravings are the cravings to be at Jhana Grove during the retreat. Yeah, very, very wholesome craving. Yeah. Wholesome cravings is anything that leads you onwards on the path. Wholesome craving is what leads you to make you a better person. Wholesome cravings are the cravings to sit down and do some meditation practice. These are kind of the cravings that take you on, forwards on the path. There is that beautiful, one of the suttas, where Venerable Ananda is confronted about this problem. And this person goes to Venerable Ananda and says, the Buddha says that, you have to use desire. There's one of the idipadas, it's called the chanda samadhi, the samadhi that arises from chanda, meditation arising from desire, basically. And then this person says, you are contradicting yourself because you're supposed to give up desire, and yet you are saying that desire is part of the path. So how can you make sense of this? And of course, the answer is that you need desire to overcome desire. You use desire to start practicing the path, and through that practice, eventually you overcome desire. It's really as simple as that. In the same way, it is impossible to overcome all defilements straight away. Attachments are part and parcel of being a human being. Having a degree of sense of self is part of what it means to be a human being. And so we need to use our defilements, use those unwholesome tendencies in the most positive way possible, and then we're using them to overcome the negative things and eventually overcoming things completely. Okay, everyone, that is all for tonight. So, again, I wish you a very good night's rest. Please have a nice sleep, and then we'll see you back again tomorrow morning.